Charlotte Perriand is the most interesting woman in the world of 20th century design. Her life story reads like a spy adventure novel. She helped pioneer the modernist movement in architecture and interior design. She escaped France as the Germans were invading, on a ship bound for Japan. She hid in an attic with her baby from murderous revolutionaries in Vietnam, avoiding almost certain death. She hiked and skied and built portable shelters in the Alps. She visited her husband in Rio and traveled to exotic locations like Tahiti and the Windward Islands before they were polluted by tourism. And she designed and oversaw construction of one of the premier French ski resort destinations. Through it all, she exhibited a zest for life and a desire to combine technology with arts and crafts to improve people's lives around the world. She exemplified the idea of Henry David Thoreau that before you sit down to create, you have to stand up and live life. Her Life of Creation, the title of her autobiography, was a life of exhilarating experience. It was also a life of wrestling with contradictions, reconciling global modernism with traditional regionalism, technological progress with preservation of culture, and socialist ideals with the totalitarian realities of the 20th century. In this episode, we'll explore these themes in Perriand's own words and reflect on what it might mean for us as designers today. We can't talk about Charlotte Perriand without talking about modernism. This is a movement that she's closely associated with and has an interesting relationship with, because although she started right in the middle of it, she seemed to move away from some of these ideas later on. So just going to start out with kind of this baseline description of the modernist movement. I'm just going to read a little bit from Wikipedia here. Modernism is a philosophical, religious, and arts movement that arose from broad transformations in Western society during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The movement reflected a desire for the creation of new forms of art, philosophy, and social organization, which reflected the newly emerging industrial world, including features such as urbanization, architecture, new technologies, and war. Artists attempted to depart from traditional forms of art, which they considered outdated or obsolete. Modernist innovations included abstract art, stream of consciousness novel, montage cinema, atonal and 12-tone music, divisionist painting, and modern architecture. Modernism explicitly rejected the ideology of realism. Modernism also rejected the certainty of Enlightenment thinking. And many modernists also rejected religious beliefs. While some scholars see modernism continuing into the 21st century, others see it evolving into late modernism or high modernism. Postmodernism is a departure from modernism and rejects its basic assumptions. Okay, so with that, let's look at some initial passages from the book here. In talking about her work in architecture and working with Le Corbusier, who is one of the most prominent modernist architects. She writes, after Via La Roche came the design for Via Church in Via d'Avray, where I learned that there are no ready-made formulas. Quote, architecture is functional by definition. Otherwise, what is it? A piece of junk, Le Corbusier declared during an interview. So we see in this quote the familiar idea that form follows function. That's kind of one of the core tenets of the modernist view, particularly in architecture. Later she writes, this is in the context of preparing some of their interior designs for an exhibition. And she's talking about one of the other people that she worked with. This was actually Le Corbusier's cousin. Pierre Jeanneret had brought along several issues of L'Esprit Nouveau to decorate the display areas, as well as his collection of delicate clay pipes. Other storage units were fitted beneath the strip window and featured a number of small displays, a dummy with movable joints, pebbles, and glass test tubes with roses inside, just coming into flower. We were effectively thumbing our noses at the decorative arts. So yeah, this would be the kind of the late 1920s, early 1930s. And you can see they're sort of intentionally departing and trying to make a statement with their designs, which she really felt were representative of what she called the machine age. Another one here, this is in response to some criticism from a journalist that when it came to some of the tubular furniture that they were creating, they were really just copying original work by Marcel Breuer, who had also done this kind of tubular steel chair. Corbu was the black sheep, and Pierre and I were henceforth in the same boat. These insults were like water off a duck's back to us. Nothing could shake our certainties, creative calm, or joy of working toward building and expressing our epoch. We were aware that we were part of an ongoing process. We went down in history due to the simple fact that we were contemporary. The chaise lounge has become one of this century's icons. So what I find interesting in this line, it's really representative of the mindset they had that they were doing something completely new and that they were breaking new ground here and that this was the new thing and the thing that was going to define this time period. And they were very certain about it. Speaking of certainty, this is Le Corbusier speaking at a conference where he's talking about his sort of philosophy around modernist architecture and the role that air, sound, and light play. Having described how, at the age of 23, he had stood in front of the Acropolis and acquired, quote, the notion of invincible truth, unquote, he went on to sing the praises of color, quote, the very expression of life, unquote, before exhorting those of us in modern times to, quote, meet the requirements of the next millennium with respect to human biology by creating, quote, a new urban environment. Air, sound, and light offered a response to the needs of the lungs, ears, and eyes. Corbu put forward a solution of, quote, the neutralizing wall, which would embrace all three elements and prevent cold from penetrating the buildings. Quote, in one fell swoop, all heating, cooling, and ventilation problems are simplified, brought together in one technological solution, perfect breathing. Close your windows. Better than that, you won't need windows anymore. The sealed glass facades will cloak the house in silence. The dwelling will be flooded with light and rays of sun. Kind of a nice image, but there did turn out to be some issues with this approach. Corbu's influence on Perrion was heavy in this period. Even in her kind of reflection writing about it, she still seems to hold fast to these beliefs. This neutralizing wall and approach of modernist architecture in general, which includes this technique they're talking about here. They're using a lot of concrete. There's no more load-bearing walls. So you've got posts that are sort of set back from the facades. And this is what paved the way for contemporary architecture, where you can have these more glass-covered, kind of more light-looking, freestanding structures. And this vertical shaft that supplies services to each floor. Perrion writing about this neutralizing wall. If I dwell on this design concept developed by Le Corbusier and Pierre Jeanneret, it's because it resolves all the building's programmatic problems in one simple, lucid, elegant stroke. So again, sounds nice, like perfect design solution, elegant. I mean, everything, you know, we love in design and try to strive for. But even at this time, we saw that there was some reaction to this kind of even within their circle. So there's a quote here from an artist and designer, Ferdinand Leger, who was a friend of theirs and did work with them. He was responding to this speech about the neutralizing wall. Perrion's response was that they would need to, quote, continue discussions. And she said that theories need opposition and diversity to develop. But I think it's interesting to look at Laguerre's response here. You have chosen to move away from a sophisticated and accepted minority in favor of the middle class, who have always blocked up their windows with curtains and cluttered their living space with furniture, hangings, and knickknacks. You have unclothed these shy, simple, and slow-living people and have pinned them, stunned, against the wall that you have brought to life again after their forefathers spent all their time trying to hide it. You radically impose it. They find themselves abruptly enveloped in light in front of the smooth, new surfaces that reveal everything and where shadow itself no longer has a place. Put your plans in your pockets. Come down into the street. Listen to the people breathe. You must come into contact with them. Soak yourself in the raw material. Walk in the same mud and dust. Your concerns are more social than artistic. You headed off at such a speed that you didn't look behind you. You should have turned around. Then you would have seen that no one was following. What are you going to do about it? Definitely an interesting sort of counterpoint here to this idea of the radiant house or radiant living, as you'll hear repeatedly from Le Corbusier and Perrion, this idea that it's kind of detached from the reality of most people and the context that most people live in and maybe want to live in. So it gets at sort of this interesting dynamic between elegant design vision and contextual reality and what people actually want. So an example of this, so I have this sort of coffee table book called A Guide to the World's Greatest Buildings, Masterpieces of Architecture and Engineering. One of the most famous examples of the modernist architecture movement represented in a house is a place called Farnsworth House. It's in Illinois. It was designed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. And he was another one sort of along with Le Corbusier, who was kind of one of the preeminent modernist architects. Definitely a good example of this approach. It's very rational, geometric. I mean, it's just basically a rectangle raised on steel posts with glass all the way around. It was actually intended to be just fully open. It's set kind of in the woods. So the idea is that you feel like you're really connected with nature in the passage here, but we should try to bring nature, houses, and human beings together in a higher unity. Later on, once this place became pretty famous, people would like to go and drive by, and it's a little bit awkward that you could just see right into the entire house. So eventually they put up curtains, kind of like we just heard in the quote here about, they cover their windows with curtains, clutter living space with hangings, knickknacks. So we actually saw that play out with the Farnsworth House. And this happened later. This was a couple decades later. And then there also turned out to be some functional problems. In spite of trying to, bring nature and humans together, at the end of the passage here in this book, it mentions, "But nature, for all the respect the architect paid it, struck back. The glass envelope created a climatic nightmare for the owner. Cold with condensation in winter, stifling and insect infested in the summer," in parentheses, "the architect would allow no screening of doors or terraces. The architectural tourists and nature itself turned paradise into a nightmare." Ironically, there is a quote from Le Corbusier on the back of this book from 1923. He says, "You employ stone, wood, and concrete, and with these materials you build houses and palaces. That is construction. Ingenuity is at work. But suddenly, you touch my heart. You do me good. I am happy, and I say, this is beautiful. That is architecture. That's an interesting quote because I think we see in a number of examples, I don't know if people really felt like they were touched and they were happy and they felt that this was beautiful when they sort of met with the reality of what these modernist places to live were actually like. So let's look at a few of those now. So there's a passage in the book where Perion goes back much later. It's actually a 30-year anniversary gathering of children from one of the original inhabitants of a place that they built called Maison Radieuse. And so I guess Radiant House. And this was one of these sort of like housing blocks or housing projects that they built. And again, at the time, there was a need for this. You know, this was like post-war Europe. There had been a lot of buildings and living areas that had been destroyed. And so, you know, they needed places for people to live. And this is kind of what they saw as their opportunity to make these new things and do things in a new way. So yeah, it's interesting to go back and kind of read through her reflections of how things turned out there and how people, you know, viewed living there decades later. Toward the end of the passage, she notes that people live free lives in a maison radieuse. But there are a couple of interesting observations. If you go and look, I mean, if you just kind of search for Radiant City, I'll link this in the show notes. There's a site called Skyrise Cities, and it's got some background on this project. First of all, again, going back to this idea of beauty and this being kind of a pleasing place to live and walk by and walk into. I don't know. It's definitely like it's a lot of concrete for sure. So I guess if you're into that kind of thing, might be nice. Doesn't immediately strike me as this is a beautiful place to live. Also, in terms of people living free lives there, I mean, nowadays, this Radiant City has been listed and protected as a historical monument since 1986. This is referenced on this website here. And so they're trying to ensure the preservation of it. So residents, so people still live there, but residents are forbidden from altering the outside look of the building by repainting or modifying the color splashes that enliven the balcony alcoves. A careful restoration process of the facades is currently unfolding. Yeah, I think it's just interesting to look at the intent and the vision and the philosophy of sort of what they talk about in words when it comes to air, light, and sound and Radiant Cities. Like, it sounds good, but in terms of what actually came out of that, doesn't seem as impressive. There's another place I'll link this as well. It's called Habitat 67. This was a modernist housing project that was built in Montreal. Look at the picture of it I have linked here. Kind of think about how it might feel to live in or around this place. To me, it looks pretty stressful to look at and kind of anxiety producing. It's not what you might think of as a typical modernist kind of all glass and all flat and rectangular. It's sort of a bunch of, I mean, if you look at it from far away, sort of looks like a cardboard box fort, you know, that some kids might build and like link together. So a real life version of a sort of haphazardly constructed box fort. At least, I don't know, that's how I see it looking from afar. And again, this is one of those projects where it sounded good and it seemed like this is the realization of all these sort of modernist ideals. On the Wikipedia page for this project, it says, decades after Habitat, much of Safdie's work still holds to the concepts that were so fundamental to its design, especially the themes of reimagining high-density housing and improving social integration through architecture that have become synonymous with his work. However, The Guardian quoted the Walrus assessment of it as a, quote, failed dream. I mean, obviously that's, you know, one critic's assessment, but I think you tend to see a lot of that with these projects and sort of failing to live up to the original ideals that they were conceived in. So one more interesting example to touch on is Brasilia. This is the government center in Brazil that was planned, built in the mid-1950s. Le Corbusier was involved, but I think the primary architect here was Oscar Niemeyer, who is Brazilian. I'm going to read a little bit from a book called Modern Architecture, A Critical History. This is by Kenneth Frampton. Interesting to look up and read some of the things that Perrion talks about in her book from a more critical perspective. Brasilia, planned by Costa in the mid-1950s, brought the progressive development of Brazilian architecture to a point of crisis. This crisis destined eventually to provoke a global reaction against the precepts of the modern movement, permeated the entire project, not only at the level of the individual building, but also at the scale of the plan itself. The conceptual schism that had already occurred at Chandigarh in 1951, so just as a brief aside, that is a kind of government center that was built in India by Le Corbusier and sort of managed by his cousin, Pierre. So the schism that had already occurred there in 1951, between the isolated monumentality of the government center as designed by Le Corbusier and the rest of the city, was to be repeated at Brasilia, where the overall plan was somewhat less systematic in its basic conception. So just skipping ahead, it talks about here, moreover, soon after its foundation, Brasilia emerged as two cities, the monumental city of government and big business to which the bureaucrats commuted by air from Rio, and the shantytown or favela, whose inhabitants served the radiance of the high city. Even within its own confines, Brasilia, like Le Corbusier's Via Radius of 1933, was a divided city, zoned into separate sections to accord with its class structure. Yet, aside from the manifest social inequity enforced by such an arrangement, Brasilia also produced formalistic and repressive results at the level of its own representation. In this connection, it may be argued that Le Corbusier's development at Chandigarh foreshadowed a critical point in Niemeyer's own career, for clearly Niemeyer's work became increasingly simplistic and monumental after the publication of the first sketches for Chandigarh. Skipping ahead a little bit to this quote from Max Bill, the curtain walls at Brasilia were left unshielded from the sun, although faced with heat-absorbent glass. This indifference to climate seems to have arisen out of a desire to represent the institutions of government by platonic forms whose purity would stand in strong contrast to the glazed and repetitive slabs housing the ministries. That the initial exuberance of modern Brazilian architecture contained within itself the seeds of such decadent formalism seems to have been most clearly appreciated by Max Bill, who condemned Niemeyer's 1954 Palace of Industry for Sao Paulo in the following decisive terms. Max Bill, we heard from in episode one. He's the Swiss designer who was very into like the idea of designers are the only ones with taste and the public should learn about what taste is from designers, as opposed to Henry Dreyfuss, who thought that the public naturally had some good taste. They just didn't really have a lot of good options. But anyway, so Max Bill, serious Swiss designer, not impressed with Brasilia. He writes, in a street here in Sao Paulo, I have seen under construction a building in which Pilates, those are like stilts basically, Pilates construction is carried to extremes one would have supposed impossible. There I saw some shocking things. Modern architecture sunk to the depths, a riot of antisocial waste, lacking any sense of responsibility toward either the business occupant or his customers. One is baffled to account for such barbarism as this in a country where there is a CIAM group, a country in which international congresses on modern architecture are held, where a journal like Habitat is published and where there is a biennial exhibition of architecture. For such works are born of a spirit devoid of all decency and of all responsibility to human needs. It is the spirit of decorativeness, something diametrically opposed to the spirit which animates architecture, which is the art of building, the social arts above all others. So I guess we'll leave this section here, but I think that is a fitting closing to what stood out to me as one of the themes as I was going through Perry Enn's book, of this irony of modernism and this tension between ideal and execution. So I certainly don't want to delve too far into politics, but while we can't talk about Perry Enn without talking about modernism, I don't think we can talk about Perry Enn and modernism without talking a little bit about collectivism or socialism and how tightly intertwined these sort of ideals and philosophies were. I'm just going to kind of flip through, read a few passages, because there's a lot here. In the early 30s, so she was already working with Corbu in France, and she was just really enamored with communism and the Soviet Union. So she decided to go there. She writes here, in 1931, I set out to fulfill my dreams, though Corbu warned me that I might well be disappointed. I carefully prepared for my momentous introductory trip. It's kind of a long trip. She passes through Germany. She talks about meeting some Germans on the way, Stuttgart. But above all, they deliberated on their uncertain future. One was for Hindenburg, another for Hitler, while I, seduced by the communist ideal, was heading for Moscow. They were an honest and upright family, made distraught by poverty. Frankfurt. I visited public housing blocks, including a huge home for the elderly. A shiver still runs down my spine when I think about it. Two wings, one for men, the other for women, a separation of the ages and sexes. It was a thoroughly sterilized place in which to die. It couldn't be faulted. It was efficient, ultra-clean, dehumanized, and sordidly functional. So I know we're not talking about the Soviet Union yet, but I can't quite tell what she's saying there. You know, efficient, ultra-clean, dehumanized, functional, can't be faulted, but, you know, also a shiver running down her spine. So she gets to Moscow. Station was somber, filled with a resigned crowd. There was kind of a guide there from a place called Interest. She writes, Interest had designated a young female guy to help draw up my program of visits and get them accepted by the authorities. I was obviously under surveillance. She pointed out that there weren't many old people in the streets. That was true. Why not? Quote, because they're all dead. She described the terrible suffering since the revolution. And to cap it all, an outbreak of typhus had carried off practically all the inhabitants in her village, including her parents. In the end, people didn't even have the energy to bury their own dead. What a contrast it was going from Berlin to Moscow. In one place, there were starving, penniless people avidly lusting after piles of sausages, dried meat, and pâtés, all carefully protected behind fancy windows. In the other, a population fantasizing about food in front of empty shops, some of which had half-destroyed windows since they'd been inadvertently decorated with empty packets of Dutch cheese. In the streets, large banners and loudspeakers reinforced the day's slogans. There weren't many cars around, but there were a few trucks that seemed to have right of way over pedestrians. They would have run me over without a moment's thought. I saw hordes of people indifferently pass a man lying in the gutter, frozen, asleep, drunk, or maybe even dead. So at some point, she went off kind of on her own and she was staying somewhere else and trying to think about what she wanted to do. Like, she thought this was going to be some sort of social dreamland and that she might want to stay there. Someone found her a place to stay. She wakes up one morning. I found myself alone, ventured out of bed, unsure of what to do, get washed up. Maybe I slung a towel over my shoulder, just like my companions of the night, and scrubbed my hands and face in the icy cold fountain. I was hungry but didn't have anything to eat. I had to take action. Not such an easy thing. No work, no food. My situation exactly. However, although I didn't have a ration card, I did have foreign money. She made like a second trip there. I think she went twice in the early 30s. I had quite naturally moved away from my bar sous les toits. I think she's referring to her furniture design, to architecture enriched by Le Corbusier's thinking and vision of the golden age that we believed was within reach, provided we devoted ourselves to the cause. However, my trip to the Soviet Union brutally opened my eyes to what was simmering beneath the world's surface. The shadow of Hitlerism on one hand, and the aftermath of the Communist Revolution in the Soviet Union on the other. I was unable to process all the information, but had input everything. That was already quite a lot. So yeah, really interesting firsthand account. Perrion was everywhere. She was sort of in all of the hot spots throughout the 20th century. You know, we see here from her personal accounts of going there and seeing that the reality sort of differed what she thought it was going to be like. There's some other passages in different areas throughout the book that illustrate her zest for personal freedom. And so that was just another thing that sort of stood out to me in thinking about how closely tied the sort of vision and ideals of modernism were tied to this kind of collectivist socialist thinking. While on the other hand, she seems to be very appreciative of her own personal freedom. In an example, talking about a trip she went on with her first husband and some friends, "I stayed drunk on freedom. I stayed for those long, golden, sandy beaches that beckoned me. I stayed for the sight of a naked man on horseback riding through the white froth of the ocean in the rising dawn. I stayed to breathe in those Mediterranean scents. I clambered over the rocky shrubland, alone under the blazing sun, along a narrow footpath projecting over the sea. I met with my friends at the next stop and didn't go off alone again. I was free. Life was beautiful, and I breathed it in avidly." In another passage here, "One year I spent my summer vacation on the Adriatic coast in the small guest house of a private villa whose owners lived in Zagreb. I would accompany fishermen on their trips out to catch the tuna that chased behind schools of sardines. In the evenings, after washing the salt from my body and primping, I would go dancing in the village square to the sound of a gypsy orchestra, or take midnight dips in the luminous ocean, soothed by serenades of men perched on rocks. Life was truly worth living. My time was my own, and although I had no social welfare, neither did I have taxes or red tape to worry about. I was free, my butt parked on the beach." So yeah, these accounts of her living her life out in these different areas, certainly a stark contrast to, you know, what she saw in the communist Soviet Union, and sort of representative of the kind of person she was and how that was in contrast to the outcomes of the modernist approach. She does reflect what went wrong. Thinking about communism, she asks, "What went wrong? These concepts of change and new life attained through death weren't supposed to create constraints, oppression, and dictatorship." Let's back up on this one for a second. New life attained through death. It's kind of where we ended up. I'm not sure what she meant by that. Let me just try this again. "What went wrong? These concepts of change and new life attained through death weren't supposed to create constraints, oppression, and dictatorship. Progress implies freedom and play, not dictatorship in any of its forms. What happened is not necessarily due to the philosophy of communism, but rather to the way it was applied on a political level, insofar as there was no consideration for the underlying nature of human beings and their degree of evolution. It is impossible to live as a true community without a high level of individual awareness. I remember people referring to nature as man's slave, but any kind of enslavement results in the shoe ending up on the other foot. A softer approach would have been better. I have always hoped that a love of life will prevail over everything else. My steps in the social and political sphere were to influence my professional life. So she continues on there. This is a pretty familiar view and argument that's made that it wasn't the philosophy that was wrong. It was the way it was applied. I mean, I think we've seen time and time again that it just doesn't work. And it is the thing. The thing is the problem. But yeah, so I think even in her reflection on this, she's kind of expressing some naivete there about what's really possible and what's reality. And I think it colors some of her other thoughts and views in, you know, much later in the book when she's talking about the end of life and death of Pierre Jeanneret, her friend, partner, cousin of Corvu. She writes, at the time of his death 2 years later, he was already little more than a corpse. Life isn't worth living if you can't stand up on your own 2 feet. That kind of statement, a little bit concerning. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who might be getting around in wheelchairs that might take issue with that statement. Maybe there's something lost in translation there. Something for us to think about and be mindful of as designers. You know, we talk about human-centered design, and that certainly seems consistent with what she is talking about in this previous passage here about, you know, it's impossible to live as a true community without a high level of individual awareness, no consideration for the underlying nature of human beings. I think we just have to be careful when we get into these ideas of grand visions for elegant solutions that are going to make life better for everyone. At some point, what we've seen here is that you get into kind of deciding what does a good life mean and sort of who's in and who's out and things like that. So it can be a kind of dangerous line to walk when your philosophy crosses over or is connected to political implementation. And so anything that's happening on a large scale that involves a lot of people, it's just something that we have to be careful of. Although Perrion began her career as a poster child for modernism, she seems to depart from some of these foundational ideas, focusing later on more contextual tradition as opposed to this homogenous international style and artisan craft as opposed to industrialized mass production. Or at least she seems to be looking for a more nuanced balance between the two. The international style is kind of associated with Mies van der Rohe, who we talked about earlier, this idea that there's kind of these universal themes and ideas that can be applied anywhere at any time. So you could, you know, have a building that could be seen in New York or Rio or Singapore or Sweden, and they could all look exactly the same. And then when it comes to production, Perrion did not want to lose the human touch of artisan craft. So I have a few passages here that I think illustrate this. Delivering a lecture in Hanoi just after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, she says, I had carefully alternated 16th century Japanese buildings with the most avant-garde architecture, that of Le Corbusier and Pierre Jeanneret, Mies van der Rohe and Alvar Aalto. The affinities were so strong that lay people who made up the audience could not perceive the differences between them. The spirit of truth in the designs had erased time. In one sense, we see this idea of, she says, the spirit of truth, this kind of universality that exists across time here between 16th century Japanese architecture and modern architecture. But also, I think another way to look at it is that there are things from the past that we don't just discard it, because it's old and we only have to think about new things and create new things all the time, that there is a history there that's relevant. Later on, when she was, this is later in the mid-50s now, when she's curating an exhibition on Japanese design, she says, "My goal wasn't to emphasize the folkloric aspect of these dwellings, but rather to demonstrate their universal qualities and modernism that had so fascinated me. I wanted to share their charm with architects and the public to prove that standardized units could generate harmony rather than monotony and could give rise to a plurality of ideas." So again, I think what she saw here was sort of historical or traditional evidence for some of the ideas of modernism. So she was very into these kind of, you know, standardized units, standardized storage, componentizing pieces of rooms and buildings. So I think she found some kind of inspiration and support for this, particularly in traditional Japanese work. I think she started to feel like she was really using a combination of these things. And she actually writes at one point here, "I mixed European use and Japanese techniques, tradition, selection, creation." I mean, just the fact that she's using the word tradition there seems like a departure from modernism, where it's an explicit rejection of tradition in many ways. And then how she's thinking about the kinds of experiences that she wants to create. Later on, she became very involved in designing and sort of developing these ski resorts, recreational areas in the French Alps. And in thinking about her approach, she writes, "I wanted a place filled with memories from the past to hand down to little ones who clamored, 'Tell me, tell me.' It would be contemporary architecture, but free of zoning constraints. It would unleash creativity and introduce a fresh aspect of innovation, which would respond to the motions that generate the forms, as should always be the case. An architecture without architects, sensitively conceived with users in mind. An architecture that acknowledged the roots of our tradition while looking to the future. Just like Corbusier's Pavillon des Thèmes Nouveaux, or his Mourandin design and Roquebrune cabin, an architecture that never ruled anything out." So again, here in this passage, it feels like a mix of contemporary architecture and just sort of this freedom, creativity, innovation, but also something that, quote, acknowledged the roots of our tradition. Again, really mixing these two ideas. In another passage about pre-war Japan, and so again, maybe this is some of her influence there, because she seemed to be very influenced by her experiences in Japan. So she's talking about a father and son team here who are artisans, craftspeople. And I'm not going to be able to pronounce this name well either. "While Soetsu Yanagi saw a timeless beauty and truth in objects crafted by the people, his son, Sori, who accompanied me, disagreed, feeling that they represented the past. Sori cared only for the present and the future. He could not see why these handcrafted objects should be deemed any better than industrially produced ones. Sori was a purist and would remain one. He became a well-known designer, his creations marked by pure lines and organic forms. He took over the Mingay Kan on his father's death and combined the two types of production, handcrafted and industrial, seeking a perfect blend. He followed the tradition of working within one's time. In 1940, although he was still a young man, he gave me invaluable insight that helped me untangle the contradictions I would encounter." I think this is a great quote because you can see here she's working with these people in Japan. She's telling us about sort of the approach and experience of the son, Sorinagi, who kind of starts out, you know, only caring about the present and the future, not really seeing any particular preference or additional value in handcrafted objects, but that later he combines these approaches into a perfect blend. And so I feel like that's where Perion ended up in her path. She says here that he provided her invaluable insight. And again, referencing here these contradictions that I think keep sort of popping up throughout her story. Couple more here. So this is kind of later in the book. She's just thinking about, in general, how we do things. And she notes that, "I can't help but think that manual work is underrated in our schools. We seem to be totally unaware of the beautiful things that our hands can create. I wonder if the promised age of intelligent robots will result in our hands being stripped of their humanity and qualities." So in this passage, this kind of foreshadows a little bit the next section I want to get into, where she also seems to struggle with these contradictions of progress and technology. We have technology that sort of creates new opportunities and innovation. It also sort of results in leaving behind or marginalizing other people and places. There's a tension and a contradiction there. But just going back to this idea of handcrafted versus industrial, this is something that comes up again and again throughout her recounting of her approach and how she designed and built various things. She was very appreciative of craftspeople who could do amazing things with wood or even just kind of the mechanical innards of a building and being able to put all that stuff together, and sort of all of the manual laborers that brought these projects to life. She's sort of continually amazed by them and appreciative of that work. And I think it's something that she wants to make sure that we don't lose as we, throughout the 20th century, continue to move more and more toward a mass production approach. One thing I came across in my readings related to her book is something called critical regionalism. I hadn't heard of this before, but it was kind of interesting because the book I read from, called Modern Architecture, A Critique, with the passage on Brasilia, that book was actually by Kenneth Frampton, who is the historian theorist most associated with this idea. So just reading a little bit from Wikipedia here. "Critical regionalism is an approach to architecture that strives to counter the placelessness and lack of identity of the international style, but also rejects the whimsical individualism and ornamentation of postmodern architecture. The stylings of critical regionalism seek to provide an architecture rooted in the modern tradition, but tied to geographical and cultural contexts. Critical regionalism is not simply regionalism in the sense of vernacular architecture. It is a progressive approach to design that seeks to mediate between the global and the local languages of architecture." So that, to me, sounds like a very good description of Perion's approach. And although she doesn't use those words exactly, and she doesn't talk about regionalism, and her name doesn't seem to come up in this context, from my reading of her personal accounts of her work and her views, that seems to be the kind of approach that she took. And I think that comes through in a quote here. This is pretty early in the book where she's just sort of talking about her general philosophy. She writes, "It is vital to take into account people's habits and constraints, the society in which they live, the geographical site, climate, and environment, production quantity, available materials, and the project's budget and plans for the building's upkeep also must be accounted for, as they will dictate whether components should be handcrafted or mass-produced." So here, I think this is a good example of her just kind of listing out the kinds of things that she's thinking about. And in her later work, and probably what I think what she might feel is sort of her most representative work that happened later in her life in the kind of in the 60s, really up through the 70s, almost into the 80s, where she worked on this whole series of ski resorts, Les Arcs. It was very important to her and the other people in charge of that project to have these buildings and these recreational areas really feel integrated into nature, into the mountains, to have them, when you were in there, feel like you were a part of nature. And so they thought a lot about orientation of buildings and windows in relation to the sun, in relation to each other. They really thought about, you know, what you would be seeing at different times, and really just wanting the whole built piece of the area to impinge upon the environment as little as possible. They drew materials from the surrounding area. I mean, everything was about sort of local production, local people and culture kind of contributing to these places. It does seem, going back to this definition of critical regionalism, which seems to try to find this happy medium in between the international style, which is one thing for everyone, everywhere in the world, versus postmodernism on the other side, which is everyone's a special snowflake and everything is unique and intentionally playful. Trying to find the middle ground between those two, acknowledging tradition, but not being stuck in it. So another aspect of contradiction that came across to me in Perrion's book is her attitude toward progress and commercialism or commercial success. As we talked about earlier, she started out, you know, in the 20s talking about the machine age and expressing their epic, creating this new way of living for people. Everything was about combination of the architecture, how buildings were constructed, how cities were organized, how interiors were constructed as part of those buildings. They were trying to define a new way of living for people, which presumably included people buying things, people living in urban areas, and that sort of thing. So it was very much a part of the movement that she was in and what she was doing. But then as you go through the book, you see there's these different sort of references where she seems kind of dismissive of progress or technological advancement and the impact that that has had on some people in some places. So just give a few examples here. This is leaving Japan after a post-war visit, so later in the 50s. She writes, I headed back to Tokyo again for a last farewell visit and to arrange to transport all my little handcrafted treasures. The techniques used to make them were slowly dying out, or the objects were being made in plastic. That's modernization for you. When she was visiting Tahiti and the surrounding islands in 1960, getting to know the locals there, she writes, Polynesians haven't yet lost the joy of living, unlike Westerners. Paradoxically, in the age of computer communication, we have withdrawn into ourselves, resulting in loneliness. In Rio, when she was sort of looking around for local inspiration to furnish the house that was chosen by her husband, who was there for his job, she writes, all I'd needed was that breath of indigenous air supplied by Lucio Costa in order to apply my own rule of motion form technique to this company residence intended for representational duties. This is in Indochina, now Vietnam, when arriving in December 1941. She writes, the road from Haiphong to Hanoi was straight, the first indication I'd seen of the 20th century. This rigid geometric figure was a violation of nature and came as a shock. It cut through the rice paddies where a host of tiny, obstinate figures labored. I like this one because she's talking about this straight road, a rigid and geometric figure That's pretty standard fare in modernist architecture. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. In reflecting on this shepherd they met, I think this was in some kind of exploration she was doing. It might have been for looking at a place they were going to build. She writes, "The shepherd gave us a big bowl of sheep's milk for our journey, as well as butter and cheese, his only supplies. Pierre and I agreed that this man was pure, untouched by our machine age. Georges, the chairman of the mountain club, was with us and spoke to him for an hour, after which the shepherd told us his story. He had borrowed money to buy his flock, but unable to repay his debt on time, went to New York, where he got a job washing dishes in a big hotel. He stayed there 2 years to earn enough to repay the money he owed, then another two to ensure that his sheep would be truly his. I imagined him with his feet on American soil and his head in the Greek mountains. He hadn't lost any of his traditions." So that's cool. I don't know if she knows exactly what was in his head, but you know, it is nice that he had the opportunity to go to America and earn money to now be able to own his flock free and clear and live in the Greek mountains. I think that's pretty cool. So this is later, she's talking about this project they did, I'll try to pronounce it, La Maison du Jeune Homme. It translates to the young man's house. This was for the Brussels International Exhibition in 1935. So she's just kind of talking about how they set this place up, you know, sort of, you know, modern young man and kind of stuff he needs and kind of stuff that he does. It's just kind of a little parenthetical she throws in there. "Behind this, we put up a map of the moon that the young man could contemplate from bed while drowning in the sea of serenity. The conquest of space and man's first steps on the moon, which seemed like rape to me, didn't even cross our minds at the time." Returning to her time in Japan for a minute here, this passage, "I explained that I wanted to show my Japanese company that the object did not deserve to be in that temple of art, that it was ugly. Quote, why copy when you have a traditional sense of beauty? Unfortunately, you show no judgment when it comes to Western objects." So again, she was there trying to teach the Japanese how to make better products for export to Western countries. They answered, quote, we copy and produce them because your retailers order them, along with other Japanese junk. Of course, if there were no buyers, there would be no product. The bad taste was clearly on our side. It seemed to be unstoppable. In talking about how the sort of later impact on these ski resorts that they built in sort of these local villages, she writes, the older folk miss the old way of life, in spite of the material advantages. Communication no longer comes from the heart. Like everyone else, the country folk can now send their children to colleges and specialized schools and reap the benefits of television, social security, pension schemes, and so on. Everything that our consumer-driven society offers them. And then concluding, later on in the book, she's talking about her time in Brazil and the difficulty of the situation there, in some ways reminiscent of her time in Japan, where people were looking to her to provide guidance on how can we leverage what we have here? How can we make things that we can export to other parts of the world? And what she found there, that it was just very difficult and not really the same kind of situation or opportunities that she saw in Japan. So in reflecting on the lifestyle there in Brazil, in this area called Bahia, she writes, the end of this century has seen a rupture in civilization. So obviously she's looking back, she's reflecting here. So I guess it's natural in the sense of, like, you know, when you're young and thinking about the future, sort of optimistic. I think as designers, though, we need to try to be eternally optimistic. And so, I don't know. I mean, this seems to indicate that she has some struggles with the outcomes or sort of the path that the 20th century and sort of modernization took. And that's fair. I mean, it's certainly not all sunshine and roses. But yeah, it is something that to reflect on, but then also think about what it means moving forward and how we try to make progress from here. In this next section, I want to focus on some passages that I think capture Perion's philosophy and can provide us inspiration in thinking about how we approach our own work. So I'll just read through a few of these here. Architecture is musical. Le Corbusier created the modulor, that harmonic mathematical measure based on the golden mean. I use it and feel comfortable with it. Systematically repeating a number has never generated proportion. Users must be granted total freedom to make a place for themselves within the architecture. Whether for better or worse, it doesn't really matter as long as they're happy. That means they have to take an active role without necessarily falling back on an interior decorator. This way, they themselves become the creator. I don't rule anything out. There is no formula for creation. In 1950, Perion was asked to edit a special edition of a journal on architecture. She put together what she called the Art of Domestic Living. So I'll just read from her writing here. This is defining the art of domestic living. A harmonious home cannot be created independent of architecture and urbanism. It would be useless to claim that it can be attained through furniture and fixtures alone, for it is linked just as much to outside factors, such as location, orientation, and sunlight. The home should not merely satisfy material requirements, but should also create the conditions for human equilibrium and freedom of thought. We have to take a stance. Are we going to have mass or void? This seemingly ridiculous question is in fact an important one. For some, the void represents emptiness and destitution. For others, it is the key to thought and motion. The Western monk chooses the void, his cell, in which to meditate and attain a greater concentration level. In the Far East, Teaism fires the religion of emptiness as Okakura expresses in his Book of Tea. Lao Tzu claimed that only in vacuum lay the truly essential. Vacuum is all potent because all containing. In vacuum alone, motion becomes possible. In art, the importance of the same principle is illustrated by the value of the suggestion. In leaving something unsaid, the beholder is given a chance to complete the idea. The Japanese garden, an extension of the house, is designed to encourage meditation through play on plans and design components, which are often very abstract. We are undoubtedly still a long way from the modern home, but nonetheless, urban planners and architects are striving to create dwellings that will allow people to live in harmonious surroundings, enjoying a maximum degree of privacy, in tune with nature by means of a facade open wide onto the garden and sky. Peace and quiet for each member of the same family has become an increasingly necessary requirement in this hectic century. Our surroundings must be the product of carefully thought out planning and architecture, and inside, furnishings should shape the void. The stance has been taken. The world of knowledge is rich enough to fill our lives without the need for adding useless ornaments that serve only to clutter our minds and erode our leisure time. Better to spend a day in the sun than to spend it dusting our useless objects with or without a vacuum cleaner. We had to start out with the largest element in order to fine-tune it to match our smallest motions. These motions are dictated by our needs, and the task of the equipper should be geared towards simplifying something that has become far too complicated. Another stance. What is the most essential component of domestic furnishings and fixtures? Storage, without a shadow of a doubt. Spatial flows cannot exist in the home without well-designed storage units. Utilitarian walls are the answer. Then come the household, kitchen, and bathroom fixtures. There should always be space in our homes so that we can dream or lie down on the floor, just as they do in the Far East, and so that children can have plenty of room to play in. So this is a really great passage. I think this encapsulates a lot of Perrion's view, her philosophy of design, and how we can also think about how this applies to many other practices of design. First of all, the fact that she is taking a stance, having an opinion about how we should approach things, the idea that we have to look at things holistically, that you can't just fix things on a surface level. Architecture and the interior have to be thought of together and integrated. Can't just do that through furniture and fixtures alone, as she says. The influence of Japanese minimalism really coming through, just this idea, is as relevant today as it was in 1950, back when the consumer society was gearing up. She was already thinking about avoiding the need to add, quote, useless ornaments that serve only to clutter our minds and erode our leisure time. I think it is a little bit ironic. She lands on the importance of storage as the answer. I guess that makes sense, but you know, when you have less stuff, you need less storage. In our own house, we've intentionally tried to reduce storage, at least additional storage, because then it just sort of fills up with stuff. But I guess the point taken that when you think about the space in an integrated way and the storage is integrated, you know, then you don't end up buying extra things at IKEA just to fill up with more stuff. I'll conclude where the book ends, where Perrion recounts an ongoing conversation she has with Roger Godino, who was the head developer, project manager of the Le Arc project. They had some back and forth, both in person and through letters. Starting in the middle of one of her reflections, she says, "I would argue, Roger, that any creation is perilous. At best, we take calculated risks. In architecture, the plan is only the projection of an idea that has already ripened, that has been turned over 100 times in the architect's head, scrutinized and analyzed. The drawing fixes the idea, strengthens it, or eliminates it if it is not worth anything when put to the test. The idea is not rejected out of hand. It corresponds to a need, to a program, to a design process. For construction to take place, there needs to be a plan that has had time to gestate. The built work is merely the reflection of the plan, and the skills of those involved, a crucial element." Then, talking specifically about Le Arc, she asks, "What will the leisure world of the 21st century resemble?" Roger Godino effectively summed it up. "Today's fast-developing technological progress has generated greater and greater wealth and less work. Contemporary society needs a new framework to compensate for the increase in revenue and the decline in jobs. Such a restructuring will enable the industrial world to grow even wealthier and benefit from more free time. We must now define the characteristics of this new civilization in which non-working activities will play a vital role, whether they be linked to culture, leisure, sports, politics, or whatever." He continued, "Rediscovering nature, the sea, the countryside, and the mountains will represent one of the chief trends of the future. There will be an overriding need to develop facilities, to make nature accessible to the greatest number of people, yet at the same time to preserve it. In the 21st century, mankind will have to address the issue of setting up facilities in natural surroundings, all the while taking into consideration ecological and economic variables." To that she responds, "If I've understood correctly, this means having to cope with all manner of contradictions." I really like her description of the creative process here. Any creation is perilous. There's always risk involved. And that a plan is just an idea that has been kind of iterated over and ripened and fixed in some sort of artifact. But it's not really the thing until you build it. It's only a plan. And for that building to take place, you have to give that plan time to form and adapt and adjust. And that what you end up with is not going to be the plan. It's going to be some reflection of that. And it's going to depend a lot on the people who are actually doing the building. Makes me think of one last quote I wanted to bring in here. This is later on. She's talking about, this is when she's, this is actually 1994. So she's expanding her personal residence to have her working and living space next to each other. So she's going back to her house and taking the place next door became available. And so she's building that out. For a long time now, I have realized that each building trade reads its own score without necessarily grasping the overall symphony. It's only when work reaches a certain stage, when objects begin to take shape, that everyone starts playing the game. Every day, I had to draw up detailed diagrams, taking into account construction constraints and each contractor's understanding of the various concepts. I also had to gauge the scope of their skill. It's important to motivate each member of the construction team to include them fully in the overall process and make their work interesting. This is fundamental to achieving quality. Thanks for listening to Designer Sketches, my one-to-many book club where we learn together from history's most influential product designers. If you found any part of this useful, usable, or delightful, please share it with someone. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Google, or Spotify. For related writings in addition to the episodes, check out Designer Sketches on Substack. Until next time. Back, we're back, I used to front, like Andrew White, Mechanicsburg, Anchorage, Dar es Salaam.